On the program today, government being run like a business, how that's working so far. Also, tax reform, just because, and our series, I've Always Wondered. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rusnell. It is Tuesday, the 11th day of April. Glad, as always, that you could be with us, everybody. There are two things, generally speaking, that if a company says or does them are going to make everybody, and I do mean everybody, pay attention. The company in question is the Japanese behemoth Toshiba. Thing one that it said today was that its finances are so precarious that it might not be able to continue as what is known as a going concern. That is very, very, very bad in business speak. Also bad, and thing two, is that the company released an unaudited earnings report, that is, without the accounting seal of approval. Marketplace's Jed Kim gets us going with the corporate story of the day.
The Toshiba name is on laptops, TVs, medical equipment. It's a conglomerate. Japan's known for them. Think Mitsubishi, Sony. But that model can be vulnerable, says Linda Lim. She teaches business strategy at the University of Michigan.
One of the risks of a conglomerate is that failure in one line can jeopardize all the rest.
That's what happened. Toshiba's nuclear power business, Westinghouse, filed for bankruptcy. Toshiba lost billions. And that's on top of a false profit scandal in 2015. Economist Yasushi Hamao at the University of Southern California says a decade ago, the move into nuclear seemed smart.
Westinghouse facilities and Toshiba technologies, combining the two, they could produce a very efficient nuclear generator.
To sell to developing countries like China and Vietnam. So what went wrong?
One, they paid too much. Number two, 2011 Fukushima disaster.
Hamao says the company weathered past troubles by selling off its best parts. Now its prized computer chip business may have to go. Hamao suspects Toshiba will go under. Add it to the list of once strong Japanese powers, like Sharp, now bought out. Linda Lim at Michigan says conglomerates may not be part of Japan's future.
However, that said, it seems to be coming back in favor again, conglomerates in emerging markets.
Like China and Vietnam. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Okay, so, United. Apologies have been made and remade, but still, that video is pretty hard to unsee. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports that yes, indeed, there was a better way to handle it, and other airlines do it all the time.
Airlines constantly have to move their crews around in order to get them to the planes and the flights they're assigned to. That's normal. It is also normal that flights that would take them there might occasionally be full. Not normal? Figuring that out after all the passengers are already on the plane and then removing them to make way for the crew.
It's known industry-wide that, of course, the fare-paying passenger takes priority.
Alex Macheris is an aviation analyst based in London.
I speak often with Lufthansa, the German airline, and their crew are constantly positioning around Europe because the flights are so full and they wouldn't dare to bump a passenger.
There is also a normal way of getting volunteers to get bumped. Pay them. Jim Corridor is airline equity analyst with CFRA.
If they do not reaccommodate you and get you to your destination within 2 hours, they have to give you 400% of your one-way fare.
United did not go above $1,000, which it could have if it had wanted to. When nobody volunteers to get bumped, there's a normal way of figuring out who should get bumped involuntarily.
Every airline must have a boarding priority listing.
Charlie Lioka runs Travelers United. This listing could be a ranking of when people checked in for the flight. It could be based on who's a frequent flyer or who paid the cheapest fare. According to passengers, United just picked people randomly.
This entire situation happened because of the incompetence of United's own management.
So in conclusion, yes, there were better ways of handling the situation. Lots and lots and lots of better ways. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
That percent or so that United stock gained yesterday, lost it today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is in Russia today, his first trip there as secretary. In an earlier life, though, when Mr. Tillerson was the CEO of ExxonMobil, he was all but a Moscow regular. His transition from CEO to secretary has been a bumpy one, you could say. So we have called Steve Call. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, also the author of a book on ExxonMobil a couple of years ago. It's called Private Empire. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
What was Rex Tillerson like as the CEO of Exxon?
Well, he was a lifetime employee of the corporation, rose from entry level out of college all the way to the top, served as CEO for 10 years. He was, you know, a sort of a steady hand at a corporation that has always bred its own leaders, pretty good communicator, but his job was mostly to fly around the world in Gulfstream jets and negotiate oil deals in private with world leaders, and that's where he spent most of his time as chief executive before coming to Washington as Secretary of State.
And now he's flying on government planes, negotiating in public with world leaders, a different thing. And I guess the question is, does the skill set transfer?
Yeah, some of it does. Obviously, some diplomacy involves private negotiations, sometimes with authoritarian leaders and complex subjects. And he's certainly well-schooled for that part of the job. But diplomacy is different, as you say, because it's really three-dimensional chess. You have to be speaking to publics and the press to shape the story of diplomacy and American interests in a way that makes those private talks easier to conclude.
Do you think he's internalized that yet? I ask because just the most recent example, his statements on Syria have been inconsistent over the past 5 to 7 days or so.
Yeah, they have been inconsistent. At least he's been talking. So that's also an evolution. When he first came in, he really remained quite notably silent. He took one reporter with him on a trip to Northeast Asia, and he told her, well, I've only been on the job 6 weeks. Give me some time. Okay, seems fair enough. Now he's been on the job close to more like 2 months, and he's started to do the things that secretaries do. He went on television for the first time. Mm-hmm. But as you point out, as he has stepped out onto the stage, he has discovered that diplomats in complex crises like the one in Syria have to be very precise about what they say. And what he has said has been a little bit inconsistent internally, but it also seems to reflect a little bit of disarray in the Trump cabinet about exactly what the new Trump administration policy towards Syria is about after these cruise missile strikes.
He works for a guy, Rex Tillerson does, famously a businessman who said he wanted to run government like a business. He hired Rex Tillerson, also a businessman, in theory to run the State Department like a business. Do you think that pans out?
Well, we'll see what it means. I think you would expect that it would mean discipline of messaging and policy formulation. I don't really see that in the Trump National Security Cabinet so far. You know, the world isn't as tractable as it might seem when you're outside of office, and trying to move a government like Russia's to change its decades-long relationship with Syria, for example, that's not an easy transaction to pull off. I fear that there's some typical learning of a new administration about how hard the world is to bend to your will, even when you're the most powerful military in the world.
Yeah. He spent decades, anyway, working for Exxon shareholders. He now works for the American public, an arguably more complicated group of people. How does that, do you suppose, play as he tries to find his way?
Well, when you're working on behalf of shareholders, you're sort of bound by law to serve their interests first, and that means when you're doing business in a dictatorship like Russia or a dictatorship in Africa, it may not be in your shareholders' interest to speak your mind about what a lousy government this is and how badly it's suppressing its own people. But when you're representing the United States, well, now you have to manage the uncomfortable combination of hard, realist negotiations with somebody like Putin with speaking out. It's a new mandate for him because it's really quite different from what he was meant to represent when he represented ExxonMobil's shareholders.
Steve Call is the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. His book about ExxonMobil is called Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power. Steve, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
On the theory that business and economics sometimes kind of don't make sense, we've got a series that we do every single month called I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blade work.
Your questions paired with our answers. Christopher Scrocky wondered this. I frequently hear comparisons of family incomes, Mr. Scrocky wrote, in 1980 and today, but I don't think that's an apples-to-apples comparison, end of quote. That, as it happens, is true, but there is a whole lot more that goes into that answer. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman at our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting takes it from there.
To help tell this story, I've tapped some typical families from history. Well, TV history.
Father knows best.
It's 1954. Jim Anderson, his father, is an insurance salesman. Mom Margaret stays at home. They're solidly middle class. Jim's just splurged on a whim, spent $50 on a cool new motor scooter for his son.
Yes, $50.
I could have bought all new curtains for upstairs.
And I could have gotten some new golf clubs, but it happened I bought Bud a motor scooter instead, and that's that.
The Andersons are doing pretty well. They can afford all the newest gadgets of the post-war boom on one income. And over the next couple of decades, families in the growing middle class kept doing well, with income up more than 60%. Here's Elise Gould with the Economic Policy Institute.
From 1947 to 1979, you saw broad-based income growth. The lowest fifth up to the top 5% of income, relatively strong across the board.
But then a new family takes center stage.
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played.
Songs that made the hit parade.
It's Archie Bunker. He's raised a family on his paycheck as a loading dock foreman. But it's the 1970s, and America's earlier broad-based prosperity is faltering. There's an energy crisis, competition from cheap labor overseas, and then...
It's just that the company announced that they're having a 20% cutback in personnel, that's all, and I think it's going to hit my department pretty hard.
Oh, Archie.
Archie keeps his job, but it's increasingly hard to make ends meet. It's been the same story since then for many families on a single income, says Heidi Hartman at the Institute for Women's Policy Research.
At the middle, the median man hasn't gained in real earnings since the late 70s.
Here are the numbers from the Census Bureau. After adjusting for inflation, median income for a family with a single earner has risen just 6% since 1980. For a family with two earners, income is up 42% to just under $100,000 a year.
I mean, middle-class family incomes would not have grown at all if it had not been for women's work.
So that today, we've got TV families, like the Hacks on ABC's The Middle, valiantly holding on to a middle rung on the economic ladder. There's Mom Frankie, who becomes a dental hygienist after first working as a car saleswoman.
I have a job I think I'm getting really good at.
I just have a feeling.
Dad Mike manages a quarry. They juggle home, work, and aren't doing too badly.
Hey, Mom, can we go to Red Lobster for dinner tonight?
No.
I was just thinking you guys could give me the iPad for my graduation present.
We'll see.
Now, not all families with two working adults are getting ahead. And families in the bottom two-fifths of earning brackets have hardly seen any real income growth since 1980. Hartman says families that are already doing well can afford the services they need to earn even more.
The middle-income mothers, and especially the high-income mothers, could work more and contribute more to family income. Well, that's because, for them, the child care costs are affordable.
So it turns out that our listener, Christopher Scrocky's hunch, was pretty much spot on. Most of the increase in median family income since 1980 isn't due to wages rising for individual workers, but because more family members are going out to work and working more hours to earn a paycheck. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We need your questions to make this series work, so hook us up. Send them to us through our website. Marketplace.org is the address. A couple of months ago, by the way, we did one on why airlines overbook their flights. Kind of relevant now, huh? Coming up.
Customers have commented how much different it is when they walk into the building. You know, you just don't notice that odor anymore.
Good sewers are good for business. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 6 points today, less than a tenth of 1%, 20,651. The NASDAQ off 14 points, 0.2%, 58.66. The S&P 500 dipped 3 points, about a tenth percent, 23.53 there. We talked about United. Shares down 1.1% today. Southwest, though, went the other way, up 1.5%. Delta up 0.7%. President Trump met with a bunch of CEOs at the White House today. He promised, quote, pleasant surprises on NAFTA and, quote, major eliminations on Dodd-Frank. A few of the company heads at the White House. GM, General Motors, down 0.1% today. IBM off 0.3% today. PepsiCo down about 0.25%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.30%. I really do wonder what Janet Yellen is thinking. You're listening to Marketplace.
From news to numbers, you count on Marketplace to explain what you need to know. Get Marketplace delivered to your inbox every day and never miss a beat. Subscribe to the newsletter at marketplace.org.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The schedule for tax reform that both President Trump and Speaker of the House Paul Ryan have promised is next on their agendas, after health care gets settled, that is flexible. First, it was March, then it was August. Now, according to the White House, it's the end of the year. That's part of what the president was pushing for at that big CEO meeting today at the White House. But even more important than the calendar, says former Obama White House economic advisor Jason Furman, is that whatever deal that gets done is bipartisan. Furman is now a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington. He wrote about this subject at the Wall Street Journal not too long ago. Jason, good to have you on.
Good to be here.
So we'll get to the economics of this thing, the actual economics, in just a second. But help me understand why it's economically important that this be a bipartisan tax reform bill in your mind.
It's related to the economics, which is we have a tax system that has just accumulated more and more issues over time. Our problem is not that we're taxing too much, so we can't solve our problems with a tax cut. We need to solve it with a tax reform where you get rid of a lot of loopholes and you can use some of that money to lower tax rates. That inherently has winners and losers. The losers like to organize, and I think the only way you could defeat those losers is by getting a coalition of the winners, and that would be a bipartisan coalition.
You want Congress and the White House to get together and do business taxes first, or in fact, only in your piece. How come? Why not? Why not tax cuts and tax reform for consumers and all the rest of us?
Ideally, you do everything, but I think the real economic benefits come on the business side. Our statutory tax rate on the business side is out of step with the rest of the world. We have the highest statutory tax rate of any country. And it matters because businesses can choose where to locate, where to move their headquarters. We've been seeing all these corporate inversions as American companies move overseas. They choose where to report their profits. That's why you see so many profits reported in some of the lovely tropical islands spread throughout the world. And that's why, you know, on the business side, how you compare to everyone else matters. The individual side, less so. You're not going to pick up and move just because the tax rate is a little bit higher here than it is somewhere else. And in fact, our tax rate on the individual side isn't really higher than it is elsewhere.
You mentioned that you think infrastructure ought to be in here. Is that because basically the only area that Republicans and Democrats might even seem to agree nowadays in public policy is the need for infrastructure investment?
Yeah, there's no logical link. You don't need to do infrastructure as part of tax reform, but it's something that President Obama put out as an idea. It's something that the Republican then chairman of the Ways and Means Committee that does tax writing legislation, Dave Camp, put in his plan as well. So there's been a lot of bipartisan interest, not just in infrastructure in general, but linking it to taxes. And I think from a political perspective, infrastructure brings you certain votes. It brings you certain people that might not have been enthusiastic just about the tax reform part of all of this.
One of the reasons that healthcare reform foundered and is currently languishing is that the White House and congressional Republicans couldn't get themselves on the same page. And now we've got competing tax plans in both the White House and in Congress. Does it matter where this thing starts, or you just think they need to get in a room and figure this out?
I don't think this can happen without presidential leadership. And right now, from my reading of the newspaper, there's about three different plans floating around within the administration. All three of them are different from what House Republicans are talking about. And the main thing Senate Republicans have said is they don't want to do what the House Republicans want to do. So there's people all over the map right now. Presidential leadership would be required. And, you know, the type of leadership I'd like to see isn't how do we cram tax cuts down the throat of Congress with Republican-only votes. It is how do we open up a conversation that instead of trying to make sure we don't lose three Republicans in the Senate, how do we add 30 Democratic votes in the Senate?
Hmm. Jason Furman was the last chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors in the Obama White House. He is currently a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Jason, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
There is a not small number of homes in this country that still use septic tanks to take care of their wastewater because building a full-blown sewer system can be an expensive municipal proposition. In fact, in Tennessee in the past 5 years, only two cities have done that, built a sewer system. And one of those cities, which is really a small town just outside Nashville, has been finding that building sewers can indeed help with economic growth. WPLN's Tony Gonzalez has that story.
Until recently, when you flushed a toilet like this one in Eagleville, you could end up with a puddle in your backyard. That's the problem with old, faulty septic systems. When working properly, they filter waste and only send water into a drip field. But when broken or overwhelmed, they're a smelly health hazard. So for years, raw sewage in the streets plagued Eagleville's small business strip. And that troubled Mike Zelenik. He owns a restaurant in a nearby city. And a couple of years ago, was considering another one for Eagleville's 650 residents.
Yeah, we were not going to open if we couldn't get tied into the new sewer system. Because you just can't do business that way.
He waited, and when the sewer did come online, he signed the lease for a building that had failed as a restaurant under different owners before. To test the system's capacity, kitchen staff opened all the faucets and ran the industrial dishwasher and flushed all at the same time, and no problem.
Customers that live in the area that know Eagleville have commented how much different it is when they walk into the building that they don't notice it. You know, you just don't notice that odor anymore.
Nearly a fifth of U.S. households still use septic systems, and that's particularly true for rural towns in the South and the Northeast. In Eagleville, getting to this point took decades. Mayor Travis Brown, a part-time mayor and auto repair shop owner by day, says the city didn't have a way to pay for a system. Eventually, a grant and a low-interest loan covered the $3 million cost to serve 150 properties. But there was also local resistance, with residents worried about higher bills. Mayor Brown drives to one neighborhood where he helped persuade a homeowner a couple years ago to give up her septic system. As they met in her yard, water came trickling through the grass.
And she's like, what just happened?
A neighbor had flushed.
And she's like, where do I sign?
In that moment, the woman's concern about an unhealthy septic system outweighed her worries about a higher bill, which now runs about $50 a month.
I mean, because that's, you know, where her kids were playing in that same backyard, and you're thinking that they've got wastewater running across her yard every time somebody flushes, every time somebody uses their faucet, every time, you know, somebody runs their washer. It's just crazy to think about how bad some of the systems were.
That whole neighborhood is now tied to the modern sewer system. There have been some growing pains and a few leaks in the new pipes, but the town is starting to see developers express interest in building. That's proof, officials say, of sewer as economic stimulus. The first new subdivision has been proposed, 50 homes on 18 acres, and the first dentist office is opening soon. City Manager Andrew Ellard has tracked an uptick in property sales and building permits. And with more residents, maybe as many as 150 if families move into the subdivision, there's the prospect of additional tax revenue for the town.
Adding that to our current population of only 650, I mean, we're talking a pretty good moving of the needle there, 20% or so population growth over the course of just a couple or few years.
That's the kind of growth that larger cities nearby that have sewer systems have already seen. Eagleville will still be a small city, but one with a sewer. Down below and out of sight, helping it to grow. In Eagleville, I'm Tony Gonzalez for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, President Trump met with a bunch of CEOs at the White House this morning, as I mentioned, and while the cameras were still in the room, the president said this.
At the top of our agenda is the creation of great high-paying jobs
for American workers, and we've made a lot of progress. You see what's going on, you see the numbers. We've created over 600,000 jobs already in a very short period of time, and it's going to really start catching on now because some of the things that we've done are big league and they are catching on. Already we've created more than almost 600,000 jobs. And yes.
So about that, about the facts, because, as we like to say, they matter. Net job gains during February and March, the first two full months of the Trump administration, actually 317,000, not the 600,000 the president got from somewhere. Oh boy, look at the time. We got to go. Wall Street Today, let's just say flat. How about that? Tommy Andres and Raghu Madhavan are the producers on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.